It is a beautiful and rather tender family scene that is portrayed in the second chapter of the Gospel of Luke. Jesus is 8 days old and he is carried to the temple where certain requirements, ritual requirements of the Jewish law were to take place. He is dedicated to God. He has been circumcised. His name has been proclaimed as Jesus. His parents offer the sacrifices of doves or pigeons. The offering of birds instead of a lamb was technically called the offering of the poor, which is an early indication in the unfolding drama of the life of Christ that he was born to ordinary parents, to a home devoid of luxuries, into a hard-working family that struggled to make a go of it. Simeon, a devout man whose wife was a relative of Mary's, is in the temple. Simeon has been promised that he would not die until he sees the Messiah. So when he encounters Mary and Joseph at the temple with the baby Jesus, he affirms the special role of Jesus and says, "Lord, now I can die content, for I have seen him as you promised me that I would." The wonder of all that had happened and was happening was not missed by Mary and Joseph. But then it all was over, and the question arises, what now? It's like when a baby is baptized, and we baptize 2 or 3 babies every Sunday in the life of this church. All of the kith and kin gather for a festive and joyous occasion. The grandparents are usually here. And then they go home after the service for lunch together. And then when it's all over and the videos of the baptism of the baby have been viewed and reviewed by all, the question arises, what now? What now? The same as for Mary and Joseph, they went home to Nazareth to be a family. They went home to be a family. It's easier to say than it is to do. It is easier to talk about being a family than it is to really be a family. We therefore begin today with the essential question. What is a family? Well, our first reaction is, well, that's a simple kind of a question to ask. A family is mom and dad and 1 or 2 children. And I can tell you that that answer is true. But that is the picture of what is the traditional family, the predictable picture of the family. But there is more. You don't get very far today in thinking about the family until you realize that the definition of the family has changed. When you talk about a family today, you must also include single-parent family, where one parent is breadwinner, caregiver, mother, father, all rolled into one. It's a demanding role, and those persons are on duty 24 hours a day. And this church has many single-parent families in it, and I hope they are finding that this church is standing by them to give them strength. What is a family? It's a traditional family, mother, father, and children. It's a single-parent family, but there's more. It is also a family where both parents are working. While single-parent families are struggling with the dual demands of providing financial and emotional nurture, working parents, the two-career families, are facing the endless conflict and tension of trying to balance work and family. 52% of women whose children are under 3 are in the workforce today. The changing American family at the point of dual career is a considerable change. It is, says Dr. Armand Nicolaia Jr. of the Harvard Medical School, a home in which both parents are available to the child emotionally as well as physically has become in some areas of our society the exception rather than the rule. And that's true. He also says that my clinical experience indicates clearly that no woman with young children can do both at the same time without sacrificing one or the other, the quality of the work she's doing or the quality of the child care before her. So when you talk about family today, you are talking about traditional families, single parent families, dual career families. To define what a family is, there are many factors today. But however you define it, the family in our society is experiencing tremendous pressure and stress. Mark Novak, a Catholic theologian, has said that to be a family in this day and age is nothing less than an act of courage, and I agree. And yet many parents today, single and otherwise, in the face of all of the pressures, many of the parents that I know have a passion for wanting to do a great job for their children. Now, at the risk of covering the same ground, I must say that the pressures facing parents today are accentuated by several realities. One reality is divorce. 50% of all marriages today are ending in divorce. 60% of all second marriages are ending in divorce. The sad reality is that many couples who once said, "I do," are now saying, "I don't want to anymore." And at the conclusion of this service today, we are going to have our annual marriage vow renewal service. And while I recognize that this can be a moment of pain for anyone who is present who has lost a spouse through divorce or death, or a person who is present who has just simply not found the right person with which to spend their life, while that can be painful for you, and I'm sensitive to it, it is our intention, though, to try in this service to strengthen the heart, the very fabric of family life, which is a good, solid, fulfilling, working marriage. Dr. Joseph Sittler, the retired professor of theology at the University of Chicago Divinity School, has said this about marriage. The heart of marriage is a promise. On the face of it, it is a crazy promise. Two people who have only a partial understanding of one another stand up and make this amazing statement that they are going to cherish and care for one another for a lifetime. Someone will say, "That's a very risky thing to do," and I'll answer, "You bet it is. It's a risky thing to do, but friends, there is no royalty without risk. There is no reaching without striving and working to capture and to achieve." It's an incredible promise that's at the heart of a marriage. And I can tell you, the people that I marry, and I marry three or four couples a week practically, more than 100 people a year stand before me and say, "I do, yes, I will, I want to, I'm eager to." I've never dragged anyone kicking and screaming into this sanctuary to marry them. But they're in a state of fantasy, I can tell you that. When you don't really get to know one another until your head begins to be on the same pillow, until you're drinking your coffee out of the same pot, until you are brushing your teeth over the same laboratory, and there you are. It's like living in a room full of elbows. It's the most intense form of human fellowship. And you find out things about her, and she finds out things about you that neither of you ever dreamed about. Some of them are wonderful. Others of them will drive you up the wall. That's it. It's into that arena that you live out this promise. Somebody said to me the other day, "My wife and I are incompatible." What's the big deal about that? I've been incompatible with Sarah for 34 years. No two human beings are perfectly compatible. I walked through a receiving line at a 50th wedding anniversary celebration. Met the couple, there they were, celebrating 50 years together. One of them said to me, "We've never had a cross word with one another, preacher." He lied. If he didn't, one of them is a zombie. Never a cross word? Let's just not kid one another. You have to work at it, friends. And you work at it because you make a promise. Now, the society around you doesn't support you working at it. the society around you doesn't say, work your way through. It says, listen, life is too short. Get out. And many are. And that's one of the things that's changing the face of the family. Another thing that's changing is single parents without partners who are divorced or spouses die. It also can be a single parent who has never been married. I see that with greater frequency than you might imagine. A young woman, pregnant and unmarried, asked me if I would baptize her baby when the baby came. What would you do? I can tell you what I did. I promised her I would, and I did. And I asked this congregation to stand in support of the Christian nurture of that child. What is the mind of Christ? I'll tell you what the mind of Christ is. That is a child of God, however that child arrived here, and I'm never going to place any condemnation upon that innocent child. All I'm saying to you is that the scene before us in family life is constantly changing. Two career couples are changing the scene, where both parents are working either through necessity or through desire. I don't know how they do it. You must be under constant strain, torn and pulled between duty and desire, between the demands of your career and your responsibility as parents. The questions that must grip your mind are essential questions. Can I make an investment in career that is satisfying and still nurture my children? How can I cope with the guilt that I feel every time I drive off and leave my children with someone else? Am I leaving my baby too soon before we are sufficiently bonded to one another? As a father, do I resent the increasing demands on me as one who nurtures rather than one who merely provides? What is a family? It is the traditional family, but changes are evident because of divorce, single parents, dual career parents. And I don't have time to develop it in depth today, but let me tell you, there are also the children of poverty. They are changing the face of the family before. The children of the poor, they rise up out of poverty either with hope, or they rise up out of their poverty with rage of an inner anger at their plight and the cycle that they cannot break out of. Let me just give you one bit of information. The richest 20% receive 44% of the national family income. The poorest 20% get only 4.6%. More than 5 million of the poorest are children. And friends, let me make it clear. It's not a question of your end of the boat is leaking, you better start bailing water. We're all in this boat together. If we do not reach out and help the underclass that is developing, it has the power to rise up and overwhelm us all. The children of poverty. The number of pediatric cases of AIDS has doubled since 1986. More than 75% of children with AIDS have been black or Hispanic. More than half of them the offspring of drug users. 33 million poor Americans, 13 million are children, 500,000 of those children are homeless. 2 million children have been dropped from school lunch programs since 1980. 80% of children eligible for Head Start never get a chance to participate. 30% of U.S. high school students don't graduate. For the non-whites, the dropout rate is 40%. The children of poverty call to us today. Lord Acton spoke of the United States and he said, in a country where there is no distinction of class, a child is not born to the station of its parents, but with an indefinite claim to all of the prizes that can be won by thought and labor. It is in conformity with the theory of equality to give as near as possible to every youth an equal start in life. And one has to wonder if we have forgotten that tradition, or even worse, if we are betraying it? It's a searching question that we're asking today. That's all I'm saying. What is a family? It is not easy, as easy to answer as we thought. But we move now to another question. What should the family be? Given all of these changes we've talked about, what should the family be? We have our ideal of what the family should be. At its basic bedrock level, the family is what Robert Frost said about it. Home is where they've got to take you in when you get there. Well, that's basically true. Home, family, is a haven, a place of respite, a place of acceptance. It should not be a battleground. It should not be a place of intense competition, an arena of stress. It must be a place of rest and renewal where together the family faces life united with love's resources assembled on everybody's behalf. That's what the family should be. But let me just pinpoint it a bit. The family should be a place, one where people rejoice. There needs to be joy experienced and expressed in the family circle. That day in the temple, Joseph and Mary stood there marveling at what was being said about Jesus. It was a note of joy. They were giving thanks for the prospects of their son's life and future. There needs to be joy in the family. Somebody asked me the other day, what do you want to teach your grandchildren, preacher? I want to teach them to experience joy. I want them, when they think of their grandfather, that they think immediately, he really loves me and he's fun to be around. If they can experience joy in my presence, they will listen to the lessons that I will surely teach them. We need joy in the family. You remember Dorothy Nolte's famous quotation about what happens in a family? She says, if a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. If a child lives with ridicule, she learns to be shy. If a child lives with shame, he learns to feel guilty. If a child lives with anger, she learns to be resentful. If a child lives with approval, he learns to like himself. If a child lives with praise, she learns to appreciate. If a child lives with security, he learns to have faith. If a child lives with acceptance and friendship, she learns to find love in the world. That's why you need joy in the family. Rejoice. A family needs to rejoice. Then secondly, a family needs to respond. Respond. Families help one another to meet the challenges and choices and chances of life. After Simeon had delivered his message about Jesus, our morning lesson says that Simeon blessed them. He responded to their needs and their future. They did not fully grasp or understand the events pouring over them. It must have meant something tremendous to them, but they were responding to one another and gratitude before God. You know, you need that kind of thing in a family. One of the best things we experience in family is affirmation. We do too much criticism in the family circle, too much nitpicking. There's always somebody in the family who has adopted for themselves the sole purpose in life of keeping everybody else straight. And they run around with a chisel, chipping away. And the family reels from that tart and biting tongue and is bruised by the words that come pouring out of that critical and censorious spirit. Some family seem to have a legacy of keeping one another in their place, no affirmation. Love one another, they say. But don't tell anybody in the family. Affirm one another, but cut each other down to size. Compliments should always be followed by a stout dose of humility. In that environment, one hand seems to bless, the other seems to take it away. Bitterness imprisons life. Love releases it. Bitterness paralyzes life. Love empowers it. Bitterness sours life. Love sweetens it. Bitterness breaks life. Love heals it. Families need to be responding to one another, rejoicing, And then we need respect in the family. He is the light that will shine upon the nations and will be a glory to all the people of Israel, said Simeon to the parents of little Jesus. He is worthy of our respect. This child is going to be somebody. Every child is going to be somebody. Someone in the family must constantly convey that message to a child. You are somebody. The child brings in a test score. I witnessed this. It was not a happy experience. Mama, look! I made a 98 on my test before Mama could say anything. Daddy said, next time make it 100. What is the impression that that child gets? The impression is, no matter what I do, my father is not satisfied. I can never please him. And unless that father is careful, that child is going to be on a treadmill for a lifetime trying to please everybody and never feeling that they are pleasing anybody, which is a terrible thing to do to a child. A preacher friend of mine told me a story of a bad argument between a boy and his father. The doors were slammed, angry words were exchanged. The father left, cranked up his car, squealed down the driveway and left home. His mother heard all of this racket and came in and found the boy sulking and angry in his room. And she said, "What's wrong, son?" And the boy answered, and I quote, "Mom, I can't get along with your husband either." The names, the places, the faces, the incidents change. But reality is you cannot get along in a family without respect for each other. Family is a place of rejoicing, responding, respect, and reality. It is a jarring note in the midst of the experiences of joy in the morning lesson. Simeon said, "A sword shall pierce your soul, for this child shall be rejected by many in Israel. He will be the greatest joy of many others." Jesus was going to face cruel reality in his life. All of us do. Reality is in every life, in every family, there will be some good, some not so good, some praise, some pain, some triumph, some trauma. Reality must be dealt with in the family. James Baldwin was talking about reality when he said, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." It is in the family where we teach each other how to face the world. Well, a family, what should a family be? It should be a place of rejoicing, responding, respecting one another, where reality is faced, and where five, the family, should have some religion. At the heart of this story, unfolding on the pages of the Gospel of Luke, is a family's faith. Why were they there in the temple in the first place? They were there because they were a family under God. When the dedication was over, the record states the parents, having fulfilled all of the requirements of the law, returned home to Nazareth in Galilee. Jesus was born into a family of faith. He read the Old Testament scriptures that were available to him. He quoted them, the Psalms and other portions of the scripture, throughout his ministry. It was said that it was his custom to go to the synagogue to worship. He was reared in a family tradition. The faith is taught, and it is taught primarily in the family circle. The Muslim faith today is the fastest growing religion in America. Our Muslim brothers and sisters are zealous about the faith. They are teaching it to their children. They are reaching out to others. What are we doing? Many of us sit with the expectation that someone else will teach our children. No one will teach them very much religiously without your support and your efforts at home every day. Peter Marshall, in one of his prayers for the nation, said, "Give us a clear vision that we may know where to stand and what to stand for. Because unless we stand for something, we shall find ourselves falling for anything. And friends, all of that begins at home. Well, how do we accomplish all of that? Only by the grace of God and hard work. They returned home to Nazareth in Galilee to begin working at being a family. I see two pictures as I look out on society today. I see the picture described in the novel Moby Dick by Herman Melville, when he tells how out in a calm sea, far from any shore, they would stop the whaling ships and lower their sails and drift along and allow the crews to leap overboard to swim a little while to take a bath. In his book, Melville describes the scene. Now in calm weather to swim in an open ocean is easy to a practiced swimmer, he writes. But the awful lonesomeness of being adrift away at sea is intolerable. The intense concentration of the self in the middle of such a heartless immensity. My God, he writes, who can tell it? And then this sentence. Mark how when sailors in dead calm bathe in the open sea, mark how closely they hug their ship and only coast along the side. That's a picture of life as I see it so often. Life for so many of us. We are adrift and feel abandoned and lost, and we just need to have something to nestle up close to and to hug. And that's what the church is. A great ship of spiritual vitality that embraces all of us. And what do we need to do in response? A final story and I'm through. At the height of the integration crisis in Alabama, two first graders, one black, one white, got up early in the morning to prepare for their first day at school. Both families were tense, not knowing what would happen. All day long, two anxious mothers waited to get the news. When the day was over and the child came home, in both homes greeted by milk and cookies, anxious mothers waiting to hear what took place. And this is what happened in the little white girl's home. Well, how was your first day at school? Oh, mother, you know what? First thing that happened, a little black girl came and sat right next to me. Her mother's heart seemed to stop for a moment, feeling a trauma of some kind was on the way, and so she asked as calmly as she could a second question. Well, what happened? Listen. Listen to the first grader's answer. Mama, we were both so scared that we reached out and held hands all day together. You know, beginning here in this church, crossing this city, covering this state, moving across this nation, circling the world, that needs to be happening everywhere. In families, in marriages, in nations, among men and women of goodwill, we need to be reaching out to each other, to hold hands. And to say that we love each other. And then holding hands, looking face full into the face of God. We need to ask for His help and for His strength. Now I want you, if you're sitting by your wife or your husband, to hold hands now. I don't want to marry anybody to a complete stranger here today. Now, I want you to repeat after me. You men first, use your own names. I, John, take thee, Mary, to be my wedded wife. And I do promise and covenant before God and these witnesses to be thy loving and faithful husband in plenty and in want, in joy and in sorrow, in sickness and in health, for as long as we both shall live. I, Mary, take thee, John, to be my wedded husband, and I do promise and covenant before God and these witnesses to be thy loving and faithful wife in plenty and in want, in joy and in sorrow, in sickness and in health, for as long as we both shall live. As your pastor and your friend, in the name of the Father,